So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F-35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. The Wisconsin Realtors Association just issued an important report, Falling Behind, that talks about the housing shortage in Wisconsin, both in single-family homes and in rentals, and their affordability. So to talk about this major report, Falling Behind, thanks to Tom Larson, Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Affairs for the Wisconsin Realtors Association, and Professor Kurt Paulson. He's a professor of planning and landscape architecture at UW-Madison. Gentlemen, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Well, first of all, I want to show a graphic showing three of the report's major conclusions. And I'll walk through that, and then I'll ask you why the realtors did the report. So let's just start with that. And here we go. Thank you. Falling a little behind. The results of the economy, Wisconsin's economy is growing as housing stock falls behind. The results of this workforce housing shortage have been particularly hard on workers at the lower end of the wage scale. We'll come back to that. We are falling behind neighboring states. The shortage of workforce housing makes it harder for businesses to recruit or retain workers and harms our economic competitiveness. Tom, I found this report very interesting. Why did the Realtors commission it from Professor Paulson?
Well, I think you've hit the highlights right there. Workforce housing isn't just a real estate issue. It's a big issue. And you ask our members what the number one issue they're facing in their marketplaces, and it's a housing inventory shortage. But we saw this to be a much bigger issue than just real estate because of its impacts on the overall economy. As you indicated, employers are having a difficult time filling job vacancies, and one of the biggest barriers is the lack of attractive, affordable housing for the workforce. It's also a huge local unit of government issue because housing and its impact on the workforce and economic development is a big part of the tax base. So we felt there was need for a comprehensive study looking at the reasons for the shortage and also identifying some possible solutions.
How long have the realtors been watching these trends, Tom?
Oh, we've been watching them for years. We're always monitoring the availability and the cost of housing, but I think the impacts on the greater economy as a whole have been more pronounced in the last 5 or 6 years, and so we've been focusing on that aspect more in the last several years.
Professor, before we go walk through this report, what surprised you about your research once it was commissioned by the realtors?
Well, anecdotally, we had heard from economic development professionals and local governments the same issues Tom was talking about. And so when they asked me to start digging into the data, I knew that Wisconsin had a problem, and it was kind of a slow-burning crisis like every state in the nation. But what I didn't expect is to see how far we were falling behind our neighboring states. So on a lot of the indicators I looked at, we were either at the bottom or falling or towards the bottom of most of our neighboring states. And that includes states like Michigan that have had a much harder economic time than Wisconsin.
Okay. Let's go to the first graphic. Wisconsin has not built enough homes to keep up with population and income growth. I'm sorry, I found this fascinating. Maybe I'm too much of a wonk. But average building permits for new housing permits. Let's look at the period 1994 to 2000. 36,000 units per year on average. Then we go 2012 to the most recent figures, a drop to 16,000. But before I give you a chance to talk about that, Professor, talk about annual lots created. On average, the window 94 to 2000, 14,000. The window 2012 to recent, 3,375. Why? Why tremendous drops in both these categories?
Right. So let's take a step back and realize that part of the housing crisis is just not building enough inventory at all price ranges, and then, of course, it filters down to the lowest income workers. And most states had a significant decline in production, obviously with the recession and the financial crisis. But a lot of states have recovered, and we have not. And part of it is, right, it's a cumulative of all of these factors we identify in the report. Construction costs are up, and so it's harder to build something that's at a reasonable price range. Mm-hmm. People's incomes have been flat for many years, so demand is down. But again, developers are having a difficult time creating new supply because of a lot of the land use regulations that they face at the local government level. So when I first looked at those numbers, I had to double check them. They were quite stark. It's also that we're falling behind, because if you do this on a per capita basis, it looks even worse.
Well, NEPS on these numbers, Tom?
Well, I think Kurt's hit the nail on the head that we're down about 75% in lots and 55% in housing units from those pre-recession levels. And the big barrier at this point, what we're hearing, is twofold. One, it's labor, construction labor. Mm-hmm. We don't have the bodies to build the new homes that are in demand. And it's also local government regulations. They continue to serve as barriers, both in terms of timing and cost. Lastly, I think the other thing that we as a state weren't ready for in many areas in the country was the fact that millennials are now wanting to buy homes. People thought millennials were going to be a renting generation.
I thought they were paying off debts and living in their basements of their parents. God, excuse me.
You're absolutely right.
I'm being facetious, but millennials.
It's all those things, and they're forming families later in life. But once they start forming families, they want to become homeowners like prior generations.
Okay, follow-up question. These local rules and regulations that you talked about, they were enacted when? 30 years ago?
They've been in place since 60s and 70s.
And so the issue becomes that the regulations may have been in place for 30 or 40 years, and nobody really notices as long as we're churning out enough houses in places where people want to live. But as zoning becomes more and more tight, that those restrictions really start to bind, and then we don't see the same level of production. So again, just stepping back, we won't ever solve our housing crisis without a lot more supply, because we need units for people to live in.
The League of Municipalities, are they aware of this problem? Are they working with you guys as you address some of these things?
We have been working closely with the League of Municipalities, the Towns Association, and the Counties Association for years on this issue. The only way this issue is going to be solved is a partnership with local units of government, the state government, and the economic development industry. So we're going to continue to work with the League and other local units of government to try to resolve this issue.
Okay. Before we turn to the rental issues, let's go deeper on the housing shortage. The next graphic, the results of the housing shortage. House prices now exceed 2007 levels, but on page 16 of the report, you say house prices in Wisconsin are up 58.9% since 2000. Professor, doesn't that vary widely by region?
It does vary widely by region, but the constant quality house price has gone up even in rural areas where you've not seen a lot of construction activity. Obviously, the pace of growth of house prices is higher in your high-demand counties like Dane County, Waukesha, and Brown, where you've seen lots of population growth, lots of job growth. But we're seeing anecdotes of house price increases 5-10% in rural and small towns, rural counties.
Okay, now you mentioned specific counties. So I want to zero in on page 13 of the report. You list Dane, Waukesha, Brown, and Jefferson counties as underproduced. Talk about that.
Right. So part of what the report does is it dives into detailed level at the counties.
Yes.
And, of course, the housing shortage and the workforce housing shortage is statewide. And we hear from small towns and rural areas as well. But it's most pronounced and most severe in our faster-growing job centers. So when we talk about housing underproduction, if you're adding population or households mm-hmm. to a region mm-hmm. at a faster rate than you're adding housing units, then you're underproducing housing. So a balanced housing market, as you add households or population, you should be adding about the same number of units. Obviously, with low production and a surge in demand because of jobs and the foreclosure crisis, you had people moving into housing, but not enough housing built to kind of create a constant level of vacancy. So if that makes sense, that people are doubling up, vacancy rates are down all over the state, and so you're falling behind because you're adding people, but you're not adding the units for them to live in.
Okay.
So what that also means is young families that want to move out of their parents' house, there's just nothing available for them at that entry-level price.
This so fascinates me. Let's focus in just on Dane County.
Okay.
Again, that's page 13 of the report. Dane County, growth in households, 2006 to 17, 36,300. Growth in housing units, 25,128. Deficit uh-huh. of 11,000, leading the state.
So
underproduction.
So if you think about it this way, Dane County, where I live, it's the fastest growing county in terms of population. fastest growing in terms of jobs growth, and also the fastest growing in terms of housing. If you look around Madison, you see all the cranes, you see all the construction. And so people have a difficult time with these numbers. But the truth is that we're adding a lot more people than we're adding housing units. And we're adding jobs at a faster rate. So if you think about it in simple terms, income is going up, jobs is going up, population is going up, but housing is going up at a much slower rate. So every year we fall behind about 1,000 units.
Tom, so Dane Waukesha Brown, top ones, underproduced. Go ahead, talk about that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that I think one of the good ways to think about this issue, especially in those areas, is talk to anybody who has tried to purchase a home, especially in that lower price range, the starter home or the more moderate price homes. You hear stories of families writing offers on 5 or 6 or 7 different houses and being outbid because there is such a huge demand for a shortage of supply of housing that they're having very difficult times finding that housing to be available.
Quick follow-up question, Tom, before I get to you, Professor. A couple wanting to buy their first home, given these pressures, what should they be doing right now?
They have to have a game plan. They have to be organized. We encourage everybody to work with a realtor as much as possible, self-promotion aside.
I understand.
But you have to have a professional that can navigate the market factors. When we were in the coming out of the foreclosure crisis, it was important to have a professional navigate the financial world because it was a different world coming out of that. Now it's the market. It is competitive. You have to be pre-qualified. You have to understand the market factors at play and have a very well thought out game plan before you decide to dive in.
Is it a lot tougher for a couple wanting to buy their first home 2019 than 5 years ago?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because of the market. In 5 or 6 years ago, it was the financing world that made it challenging, mm-hmm. but the market conditions today make it extremely challenging.
And you had a PS? And
part of the difficulty for a lot of first-time home buyers, younger families is, right, it's we call it a double whammy, is because rents are so high, because rents are squeezed, they're paying more in rent, which makes it harder to save for that down payment. And the second is that the credit box has tightened and that all the student loans that they have are going to count against your kind of aggregate debt limit. So one of the things we would recommend is if you can, pay down your student loans because that gives you more wiggle room in terms of how much debt you can take on for a mortgage.
Good.
That's, of course, difficult because rent is high, the cost of living is high.
Right, and we'll get to rent we'll get to rent in a moment. Another thing in your report is the racial disparities in the change in home ownership. So I want to talk about that a little bit because I found it absolutely fascinating. In 2007, 72% of white households were able to own a home, correct?
Correct.
That has dropped to 10 years to 70%. But right. Now let's talk about the significant drop among African Americans. In 2007, 33% of African American households were able to own a home. In 2017, a drop of 8 percentage points,
right.
25%. That surprised me. Did it surprise you, sir?
It shouldn't surprise anyone who researches housing for a living because we've known that Wisconsin has had these racial disparities in home ownership for years. So the national black home ownership rate is about 43% to 45%, and that's pretty much held steady going all the way back to 1968 and the Fair Housing Act.
Okay.
Right. So Wisconsin has the sixth largest gap between white and black home ownership rates.
Sixth largest gap between white
states.
And African American of
right.
all states.
Right. Only Minnesota, in terms of our neighbors, has a slightly worse gap. And so the issue is, or if you look at it at a city level, the third largest gap in terms of cities is the city of Milwaukee. And so Milwaukee tends to dominate our statistics. One of the reasons for this significant decline was, of course, foreclosures and the subprime crisis that made it harder and harder for black homeowners to maintain ownership that they had acquired in 2005, 2006, 2007. So in one sense is we've always been way behind the national average for a lot of historical reasons, right? But then when the crisis hit in 2007, it particularly was hard hit for lower income and families of color.
Well, let's also talk about the drop in home ownership by Hispanics.
Right.
Hispanic households, a drop of 7 percentage points, not as great as with African Americans. Any differing reasons for that, Professor?
Well, I think it's you saw the same sort of patterns. I mean, one percentage point is not that much different.
Absolutely.
But different in terms of life cycle and family structures and demographic ages, that it helps to explain some of that difference between different racial groups.
Tom, the drop-off in home ownership by African Americans and Hispanics cannot be a good omen for Wisconsin?
No, it's not. And it's, again, I think it highlights the need for additional housing, especially in that starter home category. That's where we have the greatest deficiency. It's not at the very top end, but it's at that very low end so that people can get into the housing market and start moving up that housing ladder.
Okay, now let's talk about rents. On page 17 of the report, you say, moving from home ownership to rents. Because rents is a very important factor also in the report. On page 17, in Wisconsin, rents grew 21.7%, while incomes grew 17.3%. But on page 25 of the report, you say, in 51 of Wisconsin's 72 counties, the typical family who rents can either barely afford or not afford the middle price rent is the term on page 25.
Yeah.
Talk to me about we've talked about home ownership, but now let's focus in on the rent problem.
Right. So, and the two are related, of course, because one of the reasons why rents surged during the crisis is that thousands of households left the home ownership market through foreclosure.
Yes.
Right. And nobody was building anything during the crisis because of the financial crisis. And so there was a surge in demand that drives price. But as a general rule, we've seen this for the last two decades, is that the rate of growth of rents is faster than income. So even if you get a pay raise, and most of that is eaten up by rent, you don't feel like you're any better off at the end of the day. And we see that rent growth is happening all over the state. And so it does particularly squeeze those at the low end. So even at the most recent data, if your housing costs go up 5%, but your income goes up 3%, in essence, you've declined your net purchasing power by 2%.
Well, there used to be rules. What percentage of your household income could go for your mortgage, and what percent could go for rent? Are those now fungible and blown away because of stats like this and trends like this?
So the rule of thumb always was that you should spend no more than 30% of your income in rent or in housing. But what we see is on the homeownership side that families are stretching to afford even a modest-priced home because it's more expensive. And on the rent side, that we have one of the largest percentages of any state in our region of people paying more than half their income in rent. Because the truth is, what we know is that even though you're only supposed to spend 30%, for many families, there's nothing available that they can afford at 30% of their income. So they may have to spend 50% of their income or 60% of their income. And again, if we don't build enough high-quality rental housing near where people work, then they either have to spend way too much of their income on rent, or they have to live way far away, which really poses a problem for employers, or travel, or getting your kids in school.
Or childcare.
Like,
yeah. Right.
The graph on page 21 is an excellent graph that really illustrates the point, and it shows you that gap, that people are stretching more and more to purchase a home. What's interesting is if you look at this...
Purchase or rent or both?
Both. To get into housing. And what's interesting about this is if you look at this graph over a historical time period, you see that this gap today is greater than the gap that was right before the financial crisis, which is alarming.
Okay, and that graph is on that chart is on page
21.
Page 21, because one of the things I want for our viewers, how can they find this report? It's only like 38 pages. It's very understandable. So where? Go ahead.
It's available on our website.
Promo.
www.wra.com, and the site is on the study is available on our front page.
I think it's important to emphasize that the squeeze you're seeing at the middle class level, at the working class level, and of course then the more and more that someone is unable to find a house or a rental unit that fits their needs, they're going to take the first available that they can find, and that puts pressure further and further down. And so we do see that people are spending, right, if you have to really stretch to own a home, and maybe you're a first-time home buyer, and then you just don't even qualify because you have student loans, well, you're going to rent. And that puts pressure on the rental market if we're not producing enough units at any price to meet that demand.
Well, okay, before we talk to some of the changes that could help with this housing shortage, I have this question. Your report and your stats come in a good times with a booming economy. Uh-huh. What happens? You've seen some of the economists predicting a recession. What happens to this squeeze on the housing shortage in a potential recession? Professor?
That's the kind of thing that should keep us up at night, because construction costs are unlikely to go down significantly in a recession, but people's incomes are going to go down. And so you're going to have people, regardless of your income level, everybody needs a place to live. So you're still going to have adding population. You're going to have reduced income, so people's effective purchasing power is down.
Yes.
But the price of housing is not necessarily going to fall to reflect that. So we already see that in a market that is soft, one of the first things that happen is a developer is going to pull back, maybe not build that apartment complex or not really go to the next phase in that subdivision. Mm-hmm. So the supply shortage won't go away, but people are going to be increasingly squeezed because their income is going down. So maybe it's helpful to always say that housing affordability is the ratio of the cost of housing to your income. So if the costs are going up and your income is going down, that's like a double penalty. Good. So you can either lower the cost of housing, which is hard to do other than through building more supply, or you can raise people's income, which is also hard to do.
But with the existing housing shortage that is documented in your report, if we hit a recession, then that's what's keeping you up at night?
Yes.
Yeah,
understand. Because things will get worse.
Okay.
Because you're still going to add families and households.
Yes.
And that person who can afford to rent at $1,300 a month is going to take that unit, so that a person who can only afford to rent at $600 a month, those units may disappear.
Okay.
And
okay.
Not be available.
Now let's turn to what the report calls Roadmap to Reform. Some of the recommendations. Number one, build more housing. And Professor, there's a term in here that I didn't know about, accessory dwelling units, add ADUs. Help me understand that.
Right. So we talk about two things, which is building more housing, so the total supply needs to increase.
Yes.
And then when you start doing that, there's a lot of creative ways to build more supply, some of which is, of course, changing the zoning regulations to allow smaller lot sizes, more development by right, more multifamily, particularly more multifamily on, you know, bigger roads near transit or near your job centers.
Right.
But the other way we try to get creative is to allow developers or homeowners to create a more flexible or diverse housing sort of stock. So one of those is what's called an accessory dwelling unit, or most people know it as a granny flat.
A granny flat.
So
attached
would,
or
so it can
detached.
Be attached or it can be detached. So California, for example, permits these statewide. And so you can either build a small, like 500 or 600 square foot, small little house in your backyard connected to water and sewer. It can be attached to the house as a separate entry. Or we often hear in older urban areas of people converting garages into apartments. So that's one creative way.
I want to stop you.
Yeah.
Does Wisconsin law prohibit, I'm going to use the common term, granny flats?
Wisconsin law does not prohibit nor allow. So it's left to local discretion. So I've surveyed a number of communities.
Do we have very many granny flats in Wisconsin?
We don't.
Okay.
So, for example,
We should,
as part of the strategy, right? It's only going to be a small portion of the housing stock. But for, again, an aging relative or for a young person starting out, that might be a great housing option as a way to integrate more housing and diversity of housing in an existing neighborhood. So a lot of municipalities don't necessarily allow granny flats, or if they do, the regulations are so onerous. So in Madison, for example, it's allowed, but it's a conditional use.
Oh.
And so that triggers a public hearing. That's a longer process, plus the fact that it's oftentimes expensive, and it's, of course, hard for a homeowner to get financing to build an additional unit.
Tom, are the realtors asking our policymakers in the Capitol to change some of these things to allow more, I'm going to use the common term, granny flats?
We're talking to lawmakers about a variety of ideas, and the allowance for granny flats is one of the things we're talking about. That really is going to need to be decided at the local level.
Okay.
But I think one of the key issues that Kurt touched on briefly was this concept of the permitting process. And we see that as one of the biggest barriers and the easiest to fix is how do you get new development through the approval process more quickly? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it isn't. It's communities who don't follow their own guidelines. They often will identify the fact that they need more affordable housing in a certain place in the community, and when a developer comes forward with a proposal that's consistent with the community's plan and regulations, it's often an extended delay, 2 to 3 to 4 years to get the development to move forward. So, again, it goes back to a partnership with local units of government to understand the impacts of the regulation on the cost of housing.
Okay, let's go back to the graphic. Roadmap to reform, bullet point 2. Increase housing choices with a more diverse stock. And Professor, there's a very interesting graphic in here, the missing middle. Can you explain these housing terms for the missing middle graphic that we're now showing?
Right. So, again, to put it in context, that we build a lot of single-family homes.
Yes.
And we build a few, but not enough, large multifamily homes. And a lot of that, the issues that Tom was talking about, is one of the reasons why municipalities make it hard to develop any type of housing, is that the existing homeowners think that the density of a multifamily home is something that they object to. So one of the things that designers and planners have come up with is this idea of the missing middle, how we used to build housing in urban areas, which is something other than just the single family home. This is kind of that incremental density or that kind of in-between sort of housing.
Yep.
So it's the idea of duplexes or triplexes. And again, most people, when they hear duplex, they think of older housing because we haven't built many of these in the state in the last 30 years. But if you look at some of the designs that are coming out now, you can design a fourplex or an eightplex that looks just like a single family home. And that's a way of getting high quality design but more housing options. So the other thing they talk about is these kind of small scale apartments, like a courtyard apartment, maybe a walk up, or one of the ideas that's really interesting is small lot subdivisions, or sometimes we call them pocket neighborhoods, where you have smaller homes connected by a sidewalk and maybe shared parking in the back of the home, kind of a higher design element. So it looks like a nice neighborhood that's walkable, that's friendly, but it's smaller houses on smaller lots. You can design really high quality homes that are 2,000 square foot lots and 3 bedroom, 2 bath, and that provides entry level housing, right, for first time homebuyers, and move down housing for seniors.
Okay, but I want to just one more point on the missing middle graphic. You've got a term in here, live/work. What's that?
So a live work unit is the old idea of how a shopkeeper would have a ground level shop and then live above it in terms of a rental unit.
Okay, thank you.
And
okay.
those are really good in urban areas where you want to get some sort of streetscape or kind of the idea of a small retail shop with then apartments above.
Is this a growing trend nationally?
It is a growing trend, and it's the kind of thing that cities can do to kind of bring about more housing in a kind of a smaller streetscape or a main street area. I mean, if you go to any Wisconsin small town and drive down Main Street, you will see this, right? So this is not a new idea. We built these 100 years ago.
And we ought to come back to them. Okay, let's go to bullet point 3 under Roadmap to Reform. Rebuild and strengthen home ownership. Tom, this seems to be a cultural value, reinforcing the idea that home ownership can be your single greatest investment and best asset. Is that kind of where the realtors are going here?
Yeah, we're trying to promote home ownership because it has so many benefits to society in terms of higher performance at schools, more community involvement. But I think the thing that we're trying to address here is this gap between what people can afford to pay and the rising costs of housing. There's legislation that has been introduced, Senate Bill 339 and AB 316, first-time homebuyer savings account, that tries to create a tax savings account for people to save up enough money to be able to purchase a home.
Did you just endorse what Governor Evers put in his budget message?
We were supportive of what Governor Evers put in his budget, and we're supportive of this legislation that's been introduced by state lawmakers.
What concerns were raised by legislative leaders that took it out of the budget?
I think they wanted to look at it more closely. I think they were not completely sure of whether or not the financial benefits would be worth the state's investment, and I think we have an opportunity this fall to educate them more and get them more comfortable with the concept.
Okay, bullet point four, reinvest in older housing stock in neighborhoods. Are we largely talking here about Milwaukee?
No.
No?
There's older housing.
Correct me. Thanks for the correction.
Yeah. It's statewide. And, I mean, again, taking a step back, even if we waved our magic wand and doubled housing production, which we probably need to do just to make up for the shortage.
2X, double.
Right? Double it. You'd still have, in any given year, 98% of the housing stock is already built. And so it's Green Bay, it's Wausau, it's Eau Claire, and lots of neighborhoods in Milwaukee where you have this older housing stock, like the houses I grew up in Wausau, which is older and has good bones and is that entry-level housing for many families. But it needs some investment and rehabilitation. And if the property prices are kind of flat in those neighborhoods,
yes,
there's a lot of cases where, on a just strict cash flow basis, it doesn't make sense to put in $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 in a neighborhood. But if you could do it at scale in a whole neighborhood, you can turn over a neighborhood and provide opportunities for home ownership and entry-level housing opportunities.
Tom, are we talking about state-encouraged and state-enacted incentives, or is this on a local basis?
I think you're looking at, there's a number of lawmakers looking at this issue, and they are considering things like a tax credit that would be available to property owners to rehab existing homes. Maybe a state loan program that helps lower the costs of those types of improvements that are necessary to improve the quality of this housing.
There are cities that have loan programs for homeowners, particularly seniors, to do rehabilitation or fix the roof or the HVAC to bring it up to more modern standards. And the cities that do that, they understand that this is a priority, but maybe they do 3, 4, 5, or 10 houses a year. Mm-hmm. At a state level, if you had a loan program or a tax credit program, you could really incentivize rehabilitation and upgrading of this older housing stock. And it has a double benefit, right? It improves the tax base for the local municipality.
Yes.
And it creates jobs because, you know, this older housing is also very energy inefficient. And so partnering with the tech schools and training people in terms of energy efficient retrofits for these older housing just is a double win for the state in terms of reduced cost and job creation.
Housing TIFs? Tom, has that been discussed?
That has been discussed. There was legislation introduced last session that looked at workforce housing to provide municipalities with another tool to create this this housing that is not being created through natural market forces.
Okay. Let's look at the last two bullets and take them together. Make housing a priority and legislative agenda. Tom, this is kind of on your area of expertise. What are some next steps that we may see in the legislature on this issue of housing shortage? What are you meeting with lawmakers about?
We're looking at a broad spectrum of issues, and we've talked about a lot of them, a lot of the bigger goals as part of this report. And I think the thing to understand and emphasize is that there is a broad interest in this issue, whether it's southeastern Wisconsin, Dane County, northern Wisconsin. Every lawmaker that we've spoken to recognizes that workforce housing is a key issue. So the unique thing about this issue is it crosses political divides. And as you and I were discussing before, off camera, during the Obama administration, they came up with a report. It was a development toolkit report mm-hmm. in 2016 mm-hmm. that identified local government regulation as one of the biggest barriers to housing affordability. And then in 2019, the Trump administration issued an executive order also identifying local and state regulations as being one of the biggest contributors to the lack of affordable housing.
So leaders from both political parties have identified this as a needed goal.
And you are seeing it across the country. You
yes.
are seeing state legislatures address these issues, which have long been considered local issues, but they are being much more proactive at the state level, recognizing that there are major statewide impacts to the lack of affordable housing.
Okay, let's bring it home. If you could, if the fall session passed one bill on this issue, what bill should it be?
It's the first time home buyer savings account.
First time, thank you.
It's already been introduced. It's got bipartisan support. So I think that's the one that we think has the best chance of passing.
You were going to say?
I was going to say, when we talk about making housing a priority, one of the things the report does is there are a number of states that have passed bipartisan legislation in the last couple of years to address things in their own unique way in those states. And so part of the, a lot of the recommendations in the report come from Oregon and Utah and New Hampshire and, of course, California, which has been addressing this issue for years. But the issue is that in all of those states, the legislation that passed was bipartisan. Okay. So we also say, if we do nothing, then the structural trends are there. It'll continue to get worse. And are we going to take kind of a bold rethink of our whole housing system to push kind of bold policy that addresses this major shortage?
Well, Tom, we're almost out of time. So is the heart of it here, one of the conclusions in the opening pages, the shortage of workforce housing makes it harder for businesses to recruit or retain workers and harms our economic competitiveness? Is that the biggest takeaway right now?
I think that is the biggest takeaway. I think the other impact is without an adequate supply of workforce housing, it hurts our tax base. We're not going to be able to grow our economy, grow our tax base, and continue to compete effectively within the country and the world.
We will.
And we have to emphasize that people live in housing, and so families are squeezed. If you don't have enough money for your housing, that doesn't leave a lot for childcare or education or health care. And so there's hundreds of thousands of families in our state that are significantly burdened that need help.
And we're going to be hearing about this in the Capitol?
Yes.
Okay. I want to thank Tom Larson of the Wisconsin Realtors, Professor Kurt Paulson of UW-Madison to talk about falling behind. Where can somebody read this?
That's on the Wisconsin Realtors website, www.wra.org.
There's another plug. Important issue. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you,
Steve. Thank you.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civic broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol. Wisconsin Eye would not exist without generous donors like you. Please visit wisi.org to make a donation today.